mostly liberated today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces say Mosul is now fully free from ISIS control. This reporter who was there earlier today has her doubts.
The media teams that were going in were required to go in Humvees. This is under the orders of the Iraqi military, which suggests to you that they don't consider the place safe. You know, the fighting is ongoing. It's not over yet.
Also, another day, another revelation suggesting a link between Trump's campaign and Russia. But many Russians think Americans are now seeing spies everywhere.
They think that this is just much ado about nothing. And they would rather see it go away and move forward, but it's not going away because we're still getting details like the one we just got today.
Those stories, plus the hippie airline that blazed a low-cost trail in the 1950s, coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World, and it is good to be back with you. From a proposed cybersecurity plan with a country many don't trust to listening to Linkin Park in Iran. It's just another day of stories from all around the globe here on the show. We start, though, with this image out of Mosul in Iraq.
The Al-Nouri Mosque with its famous leaning minaret. There's all sorts of myths about why this minaret leans, with folktales told about how the Prophet Muhammad passed under it at some point and the minaret in reverence bowed down to him.
That's the New York Times' Rukmini Kalamaki. She was in Mosul earlier today, and that leaning minaret, it was one of several centuries-old landmarks destroyed during the past 9 months of fighting there. The U.S.-backed Iraqi army blames ISIS fighters for that. Today, Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi officially declared victory against ISIS in Mosul. That victory did not appear to be complete when Rukmini Kalamaki and other reporters were allowed into the city today.
Once we got into the heart of the old city, which really is a scene of complete destruction, we were able to hear at least 2 to 3 airstrikes in the 2-hour period that I was there, outgoing volleys of gunfire, and I photographed one very big plume of smoke that I think is a result of one coalition airstrike. So that gives you a sense that, you know, the fighting is ongoing.
So too early to claim total victory in Mosul.
Yeah, I think it's premature.
What has reaction been like in Mosul to this, as you say, so-called liberation? Are people joyous or is it kind of tempered?
Well, in the old city, which is the very last part they were fighting for, I did not meet a single civilian. I mean, the place is literally a ghost town. The only people that are there are Iraqi security forces. So I've not been able to speak to the actual residents. They're either still trapped inside their homes or, I'm sorry to bring up this ghastly image, but I think a lot of them are still under the rubble. You can smell the dead bodies wherever you go. I mean, there's this horrible stench. It actually reminds me of the scenes I saw after the Haiti earthquake several years ago. It's very similar, with collapsed structures all around and with this horrible smell that just hangs everywhere.
I mean, that is such a grim picture you draw there. What kind of effect has this fighting and all these airstrikes had on the residents over the past few months? Were you able to speak to people and get a sense of that?
I think the mood, I mean, in general, is melancholy. I mean, this liberation has come at an enormous cost to the city. And I feel quite saddened because I've become attached to Mosul, having come here so many times in the past 9 months. When the operation was ongoing for the eastern half of the city, there was a moment in time when I felt really optimistic for Mosul, because the coalition and the Iraqi troops were somehow able to liberate most of that while preserving the infrastructure of the city. Sure, there were places where airstrikes had occurred, several buildings that were taken down, several blocks that were marred, but it's nothing like what we're seeing in the old city. I don't know that this part of the city will ever be rebuilt. I mean, it just looks like a jumble of masonry and rubble and coils of rebar.
So it sounds like we may never see what really kind of was striking about the old city again. What about the rest of the residents? Can they return to what were once their homes?
Yes. So basically, this is now a tale of two cities. Eastern Mosul, I think, is already, in a way, back to normal life. Shops are open. You can drive down the street and see vegetable sellers and so on. The southern part of Mosul and the outer edges of western Mosul are also generally okay. But it's when you get to the old city, which was the historic core of Mosul, where really you're dealing with something that looks like Haiti post-earthquake.
So, Rukmini, what does this mean for ISIS? Will control of Mosul simply push ISIS to stage terrorist attacks in other major Iraqi cities?
Well, Marco, don't forget that ISIS still controls several other major cities in Iraq. That includes Hawija, a city that before ISIS's arrival had a population of 100,000, and Tal Afar, which had a population of 200,000. Raqqa, according to the last census that I saw, had roughly a population of 200, 220,000. So if you can imagine, just in Iraq, there's another Raqqa that needs to be taken. And that city is, in fact, the one that is next up for the Iraqi army to try to liberate. So I think people are not aware of how much other territory ISIS controls just in Iraq, not to mention Syria.
Rukmini, it does sound like Mosul as a city grew on you, more so than other war-torn cities you've reported from.
I don't know. There's something about this place that is beguiling in some ways. And I think part of it is the team of journalists that I work with, my translator, who goes by the code name Hawk, because having worked for Americans, still dangerous, is a native of Mosul. He grew up here. He knows the city intimately. And so I think I've started to see it a bit through his eyes. And when we were driving into the old city yesterday, it was really touching for me to see the expression on his face changed. I mean, he was clearly in pain. And although I am here as a journalist, you know, at the end of the day, this is a story for me and I get to go home. It was hard for me to see how much pain was visible on his face. And that to me speaks to what I think other residents of Mosul must be feeling.
New York Times reporter Rukmini Kalamaki, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And the other big ISIS trouble spot, Syria, it's been over 24 hours, and so far, the ceasefire in the country's southwest appears to be holding, for the most part. The ceasefire was announced last week after President Trump's face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They agreed, as they have before, to work together to try and end the Syrian conflict. And Syrians have seen ceasefires come and go many times since the civil war erupted in 2011. The world's Rich Hall is following the conflict from his base in Beirut in Lebanon. What are the outlines of this new ceasefire, Rich?
So they're not actually calling it a ceasefire. They're being very careful and using very diplomatic language. They're calling it a de-escalation zone. And it's an area in southwestern Syria, an area where US-backed forces, the Assad government, and Iranian and Hezbollah fighters are all present. It's a deal that was brokered by the US and Russia, and it had the involvement of Jordan and Israel too. The provinces it covers are called Daraa, which was the home of the Syrian revolution, where it started, Qenitra and Sweida. And the basic outlines of the deal are that the US will use their influence to rein in fighters allied to them, and Russia will use their influence to rein in Assad. And they will basically stay on each side of an agreed demarcation line. The details are still being worked out as to who will police it, but it's definitely a step forward in the US and Russia relations with regards to Syria.
Practically, though, the word de-escalation, does that suggest that the public should expect less violence but not zero violence?
Exactly, yeah. I think it's one of those words that they use to protect themselves if things do fall apart. You know, if the ceasefire breaks, if there is small-scale fighting, they can protect themselves and say, okay, this is fine. It doesn't have to all fall apart. It's a de-escalation. This is expected.
Yeah, you know, similar ceasefire agreements, de-escalation zones under the Obama administration fell apart. Is there anything to suggest that Donald Trump might be a different kind of deal maker in working with Putin?
Well, I think it has less to do with Donald Trump than it does the situation in Syria today. The situation on the ground in Syria is very different to the one that Obama was looking at. Aleppo was still held by the rebels when Obama was in power, so they had a line to defend. Obama had made commitments to the opposition that he had to at least try to live up to. Donald Trump came into power with a much weakened opposition. And during the last ceasefire, Russia also targeted moderate US-backed groups during that time. So there are just fewer US-backed groups for them to target, and Assad is much stronger today than he was when Obama was in power.
So what's the most likely spoiler scenario for this de-escalation?
There are a few. So this deal was worked out between the US and Russia. The Syrian government wasn't involved, and a number of smaller groups on the rebel side weren't involved. There's also the Al-Qaeda-backed rebel groups that are still fighting in Idlib. And of course, Iran and Hezbollah weren't involved in the fighting. Now, there is some speculation that Iran and Hezbollah might try to disrupt this deal because the legitimization of the U.S. forces in the area might threaten this corridor that Iran wants to create from Tehran all the way to Lebanon to support its partner Hezbollah. So there is some suggestion that they might try to disrupt this.
The U.N. envoy for Syria has opened a new round of talks today. What might be going on in those talks, Rich, that could strengthen this de-escalation zone?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting what's going on. They're taking place in Geneva. This is the UN-backed negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition. If you talk to people, there's not much hope that anything will come of these. They're kind of talking about what a future Syria would look like. But on the one side of the negotiating table, you have a strong Syrian government, which is dominating the battlefield. On the other, you have this weakened opposition. And if we look at the results that have been coming out of other talks, it's increasingly talks between the great powers, Russia and the US and Turkey. We saw talks in the Kazakh capital, Astana. We saw an agreement between Turkey, Russia and Iran come out of that. It's increasingly the great powers, the superpowers, talking amongst themselves rather than Syrians talking over the negotiating table that are delivering results.
Yeah, so is this current de-escalation zone giving Syrians any hope that they've not had in the past?
I think there's definitely a sense of, we've seen this before, let's just wait and see what happens. You remember the ceasefire agreed between Barack Obama and Russia lasted about 2 weeks before it completely fell apart. So there's some guarded optimism. And already we've seen in Sueda, there's reports that government forces are capturing a number of villages held by U.S.-backed forces. So, yeah, it's very much a case of just wait and see.
Which we will do. The World's Rich Hall, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
You know, Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, they've got a reputation for being ruthless and effective in getting intelligence and getting their enemies. And part of that comes down to the fact that Mossad works closely with Israeli techies. In fact, Mossad set up a multi-million dollar fund to invest in the country's high-tech sector. The agency even advertises openly. Here's more from my BBC colleague, Tom Bateman.
Get ready. He's on his way.
Its reputation may be formidable, its work shadowy, but now a publicity drive from Mossad. The video for the agency's investment fund borrows heavily from Bourne or Bond films. It's not popcorn-eating audiences they want. The ad featuring a cocktail-drinking spy appeals to Israeli high-tech firms.
Working on a breakthrough technology? Think the Mossad will be interested? Log on to our website.
This is like the main office where we started when we moved to this building.
Israel boasts more startup firms per head than virtually any other country, and Mossad has its eyes on the tech they develop, everything from miniature robotics to high-speed encryption to machine learning. Amit Bivas helps run Optimove, a software company that predicts people's behavior patterns for online retailers.
Profiling could be done on customers, could be done on any entity. So today we're working with retailers, tomorrow we can work with security agencies. The idea is once you have that data on a single entity level, you'd be able to profile based on that.
The Mossad investment launch saw the head of the agency, Yossi Cohen, appeal for firms to step forward. He said the fund would help fulfill Mossad's national mission, allowing freedom of action for visionary entrepreneurs. His call follows a growing trend by surveillance agencies to invest in emerging IT, but its publicity has perhaps been the most bold.
Hey, Dan.
Tom.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Nice to see you. You are.
Near the cocktail bar in a Jerusalem hotel, I met Dan Pfefferman, a former intelligence officer in Israel's army. He said many Israelis, after compulsory national service, take intelligence skills straight into industry, and Mossad wants to capitalize on it.
The novel aspect is that they're getting the concept at its very early stage before it goes to market, which means they're also going to have exclusivity on it, and which means they're going to have it a good 4 or 5 years before that product reaches the market and before that product reaches Israel's rivals or enemies.
Spy agencies have always sought to exploit the latest technology. Mossad wants to find it in what some here are calling Israel's Silicon Wadi.
BBC's Tom Bateman reporting there. Coming up, airline tickets on an installment plan. We take you back to the 1950s and Iceland's pioneering low-cost airline. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman with the world. If you are flying this summer and you're watching your pennies, there are dozens of budget airlines to choose from. That was not the case for flyers back in the 1950s. They were stuck with only expensive options until a small airline from Iceland called Loftleiðir changed everything. They were the first company to launch a low-cost transatlantic air service. It gave thousands of young Americans their first taste of travel to Europe. Mike Lanchin, with our partners at the BBC, dug into Loftleiðir's history. He found a couple of people who remember that first budget air connection really well, not to mention its hub in Iceland's capital, Reykjavik.
The air terminal was really, it was really just like a shack. Yet the happiness and the glee and the buzz. And I think probably as a child, I remember such pride, my father, coming out one day on the tarmac and seeing four big aircraft that said Loftleiðir Icelandic and seeing people from all over the world inside this little tiny terminal.
That's Edda Helgason. Her father was Sigurdur Helgason, the man who launched the world's first ever low-cost flights from Europe to the USA. And this is Hans Idrason, Loftleiðir's head of sales and marketing in the 1960s.
We were, of course, called the grandmothers of low fares in the old days.
The grandmothers of low fares.
Grandmothers, because we were the first carrier of offering low fares. We go slower, but we are lower.
Slower but lower. That was your. Yes. That was the logo, wasn't it? By how much were you slashing the fares?
We were slashing the fares about 30-35%.
In the 1950s, air travel across the Atlantic Ocean was dominated by major carriers, such as America's Pan Am, BOAC from the UK, and others. They were all members of the International Air Transport Association, IATA, which regulated routes and, more importantly, the fares. Being outside IATA meant that the Icelandic firm could set its own fares, up to 30% lower than its rivals, and it could use smaller turboprop planes rather than jets. Packing the passengers in with a stopover in Reykjavik, Iceland, the first low-cost flight from Europe into JFK, New York, was launched in 1955.
In those years, in the 50s, there was only one aircraft.
One aircraft that the company was using. So you actually started the first route from JFK to Europe as a cheap airline with one plane.
We don't use the word cheap.
Low cost.
Low cost. You started with one plane.
Basically, yes. Three times a week it was in the beginning, and then, of course, it wasn't really long until we had three flights a day.
Edda, you were obviously a little girl at the time. Can you remember the first time you travelled on the new route?
Yes, I mean, I remember several occasions. The trip took from Reykjavik probably almost 14 hours. But we as kids, they had a sleeping compartment. You could sleep sort of upstairs in the upper area where you, like in today's aircraft, you put your hand baggage, but we could sleep in those compartments. So it was quite a trip.
And what was the atmosphere on board like? Was it quite packed? Was it?
Well, they were quite packed. I mean, there's 189 seats and there was no first class, no business class. So all the seats were the same, but they were serviced by very good flight attendants. And there was a basically a three-course meal served with wine and then coffee and cognac for dessert. So it was quite unlike low-cost air carriers today.
In the early 1960s, as Loftleiðir's low-cost flights began attracting more attention and more customers, Hans was running the sales department in the New York office in a swish building on the city's Fifth Avenue.
I think there were five people in reservation. We went up to 100 people in no time. And we were taking something like 10,000 phone calls a day.
Edda would visit her father at that same Fifth Avenue office.
There was no computers. This was all telephones, and this was all done by hand. And I think I can describe it as I'd never seen so many shoeboxes in a room in my life, so to speak. They weren't shoeboxes, but they looked like it, because those were the reservation cards for all the different flights. It was amazing to see.
Business was very good. They had tapped into a generation of young Americans eager to explore the world, but for whom the idea of transatlantic air travel had been a distant dream. Among those early passengers was a young Bill Clinton. The Icelandic company also came up with other ideas to attract the cash-strapped youngsters.
So we were selling at the time a stopover in Iceland, which was intriguing for people, and we sold it for $12.50. Another thing that we started doing, which was quite unique at that time, it was the fly now, pay later plan.
Fly now, pay later. How
yes.
did that work?
Nobody wanted to do this. None of the bigger airlines. I mean, it was just cash or you didn't fly. But we took a chance and we had a great success with it.
Cheap flights, cheap hotels for stopovers, payments by installments pulled in the young American passengers. It wasn't long before Loftleiðir was nicknamed the Hippie Express.
I can't wait to see. I remember you know, a night sort of in the summertime at JFK. There were literally, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people there and, you know, a lot of hippies, people with long hair. And then we got on board. And in those days, smoking was allowed on the aircraft. And at one point, I remember thinking, well, these people, you know, there were lots of laughter. And then I asked my mother, what was that smell? What was that smell? It didn't quite smell like a regular cigarette.
It wasn't unusual that the hippies, they just took out the guitars and started playing. And it was like a concert across the Atlantic.
At its peak in the mid-1960s, Loftleder was carrying more than 2% of all transatlantic air passengers, a massive amount for such a tiny company. It also helped open up Iceland, a sparsely populated, relatively unknown country, to tourists from the US and beyond. But competition with the larger airlines was becoming more cutthroat.
Now they were lowering their own fares, making all kind of gimmick in competition with us. But we tried to hold on, but things really became difficult.
And then in 1973, turmoil in the Middle East provoked a sharp hike in world oil prices that hit the airline industry particularly hard. Costs soared, profits dropped, old aircraft and equipment had to be replaced. A decision was taken to merge Loftleder with the Icelandic company that ran domestic flights, creating the company Icelandair that still exists today.
Looking at the state of low-cost airline industry now, what do you think about it?
I think this has gone a little bit overboard when you have to basically pay for almost for the hand baggage that you bring on aboard. And the cut into the service, this was a key with Icelandair when we had the difficulties. We maintained the service.
And what would your dad, Edda, think of the... What do you think he would think of the industry nowadays?
He always warned against rapid expansion. So that's probably what he would be saying. He's saying, is it viable to expand so rapidly?
I think it's all going crazy.
Hans Idrason and Edda Helgason remembering the first low-cost transatlantic air service launched back in the 1950s by Loftleder, a small Icelandic airline. They were speaking with my colleague, the BBC's Mike Lanchon. I'm Marco Werman. Siavash Sadlu was a teenager in Tehran when he first heard a certain metal band from California.
You know, right off the bat, I just felt really connected to the guitar riffs and their lyrics and their rage.
Listening to Linkin Park in Iran. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Russians, Russians everywhere, and not a bowl of borscht in sight. Plenty of allegations and counter-allegations, though. I'm talking about the whole Trump-Russia saga and the almost daily revelations suggesting links between Trump's campaign last year and Russia. The latest, as you probably heard, involves a meeting last summer at Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr. and a high-powered Russian lawyer. The president's son has issued a statement admitting he met the lawyer, who reportedly claimed to have some dirt on Hillary Clinton. The details on this story are pretty murky all around, but we wanted to know more about the Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya. So we called up friend of the show, reporter Charles Maines, in Moscow.
She runs a small law firm in the suburbs outside of Moscow called Himki. She's well-known in legal circles here. She's clearly has some connections to the government. She's married to a former prosecutor, for one. But more importantly, she's gotten a lot of contracts representing Russian businesses that are Kremlin-connected. And most notably, this includes representing the son of a high-ranking Russian railway official in a court case in New York this year. In this case, she was essentially, they were caught up in what's called the Magnitsky Act. This was passed by the U.S. Congress to punish Russian officials implicated in the death of a Russian whistleblower named Sergei Magnitsky. He died after going to prison, going public with accusations of corruption by government officials. And this Magnitsky Act infuriated the Russian government. It led them to ban U.S. adoptions of Russian children. And that, of course, was one of the topics that apparently was discussed with Donald Trump Jr. at that meeting at Trump Tower.
Now, the Kremlin has said they don't know who she is. So does she or does she not officially work for the Kremlin?
Well, she does not officially work for the Kremlin, no, that's clear. She's been representing companies that are tied to the Kremlin in some way, but as much business is in Russia, you can't hold on to vast holdings in Russia without having some kind of arrangements, some kind of security through government channels. And it's also interesting to note that Veselnitskaya issued a statement over the weekend saying that nothing at all was discussed about the presidential campaign during this meeting in Trump Tower. She said she never acted on behalf of the Russian government. And what's interesting is that seems so much at odds with essentially the statement then later issued by Donald Trump Jr. when he corrected his version of events on Sunday.
Yeah, right. So do we know who set up the meeting between Ms. Veselnitskaya and Donald Trump Jr.?
Well, Mark, are you ready to be more confused? This all comes back essentially to Donald Trump's visit to Moscow in 2013 for the Miss Universe pageant. This is where he famously, of course, maybe did or maybe did not meet with Vladimir Putin. It now appears, of course, that that meeting never happened, and they've just met for the first time at the G20. But, you know, essentially this story goes back to the intersection of Russian politics, business, pop, and corruption. The Miss Universe pageant was licensed by a family called Agalarov. Now, Araz Agalarov is one of Russia's richest men. He hosted and licensed the pageant from Donald Trump. And of course, you don't remain one of Russia's richest men without being connected to the Kremlin. So Donald Trump may not have met Vladimir Putin during that trip, but certainly he got along well with the Agalarov family. So well, in fact, that Agalarov's son is a pop star here in town named Amin. He actually made a video with Donald Trump where Donald Trump has a cameo along with some of the beauty contestants from the Miss Universe pageant. And it's this Amin who apparently, it seems, made the request to Donald Trump Jr. to arrange for this meeting with the lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya.
So why would the son, Amin, want to set up a meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and the lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya?
Well, Amin says he's a friend of Donald Trump. So this is the way Russian politics work, frankly, and Russian business works. You destroy your opponents with kompromat, black PR and things like that. So maybe it's just working with the MO of the Russian system. Or maybe he is being passed along information from mediators from the Russian government because, you know, Amin, as I said, his father is well connected in Kremlin circles. There are pictures of him with the Russian president, with the prime minister. So this family is certainly connected. Now, do we have any reason to know that for a fact that, of course, they got this information past the Russian government? We don't. And certainly it is a little interesting to say, you know, Veselnitskaya, this Russian lawyer, she is representing companies. She's doing some work. She's clearly a Russian patriot. For example, on her Facebook page, she's got a picture of the Russian flag, which is, you know, nothing wrong with that. But it's a long distance from being a lawyer for sort of Kremlin-connected entities to being the Russian government's courier for messages to the Trump campaign. So, you know, there are a lot of questions here, but certainly the links and connections here are very interesting.
Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
It almost feels like with Trump that sometimes he tweets just to focus group stuff, like this plan he and Vladimir Putin apparently came up with to establish a joint cybersecurity unit that would create an impenetrable shield against things like hacking of elections. Then U.S. politicians, including a lot of Republicans, said it was a crazy idea akin to putting a wolf in a hen house. You can guess who's the wolf and who's the hen. And now Trump seems to be backing off the plan. There are a lot of countries collaborating on cybersecurity, so we thought we'd find out how some of it actually works. Jakub Janda is with the European Values Think Tank. It's based in Prague. So you head the Kremlin Watch program, which, among other things, tracks Russia's cyber efforts against Western democracies. What was your reaction when President Trump suggested working with Russia on cybersecurity?
Well, actually, first I had to check whether it was real, whether it wasn't a fake tweet.
But apparently, it was.
Yeah, and actually, it was real. And I've even heard people saying, well, it's like teaming up with ISIS to fight terrorism, because basically, Russia is the number one country which does electoral interference. So, honestly, it was a pretty ridiculous idea when I heard it.
And yet, we've had Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, defending Trump's suggestion. She said, essentially, we can't trust Russia, but we have to keep those that we don't trust closer and keep an eye on them. Do you see any truth or logic in that?
Well, in general, yes, but American intelligence agencies have tried it quite often during Obama times and during Bush Jr. times as well. It has never worked out. So any, let's say, joint group on cybersecurity directly with Russia, so a bilateral one, honestly doesn't make sense. And I think the American president actually acknowledged that by tracking it back, actually.
When do these cybersecurity collaborations work best? What have you seen in Europe?
I think they pretty much work well within NATO, so within various formats of the allied structure. They also work pretty well bilaterally with the US. And there is a huge need for collaboration in this. But honestly, it's happening on the working level. So we don't need the political decision for this right now. What we have a need for is actually pressing the Russians to stop what they are doing in our countries in Europe or in the United States right now.
So you've been working closely with officials in European countries that are concerned about Russian interference in upcoming elections. Germany, for example, they're actively taking steps to prevent Russian interference in their election. What are you hearing from other European leaders and countries about this proposed idea?
Well, they understand that this is not going to happen. I mean, this particular idea. But they can see that President Trump wants to work with the Russians on something else, on anything that would create a win for him as he wants it. So they are pretty worried about it because they have seen this during the Obama years as well. And they know what basically giving space to the Russians means. It means inviting more aggression. They do see the need to work with Russia on some issues like Syria. But there is a difference between working with somebody on something, which you generally do with your allies, for example, within NATO, and just talking to countries which are your adversaries, which Russia in these days practically is in Ukraine, in Syria, or in cyberspace as well.
So could this deter world leaders from working with the U.S. on cybersecurity issues in the future?
I mean, politically, it's pretty disturbing. The working level cooperation between Europeans and Americans is happening quite well, and it will go on as planned. But for European political leaders and their intelligence agencies, this is worrying because President Trump is at least considering those, I would call it, ridiculous steps. So it is pretty disturbing right now.
Well, you head the Kremlin Watch program. What is your biggest concern about the cyber capabilities of the Kremlin?
In general, it's how well they operate because they know pretty well what are our vulnerabilities. And it's generally happening in the cyberspace, but it's not, technically speaking, only cyber operations. It's, for example, creating disinformation in the cyberspace, which is then translated into physical political action on the ground as well. So that's what we could see Russians doing pretty well. And there are some European governments which are pushing back against this, against what Russians are doing in our European countries, for example, because they are concerned first about their elections being potentially interfered with. And that's what you can see today in Germany, Czech Republic, or Sweden, which is having parliamentary elections next year. Because those countries can see pretty well what happened in France, the US, and they don't want this to repeat in their own case as well.
Jakub Janda with the European Values Think Tank in Prague. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to turn our attention to the climate crisis for the next few minutes, but this is not a story about flooding or heat waves or rising seas. It's about how the ripple effects of climate change are reverberating in one of the world's most sparsely populated countries and contributing to an urban pollution crisis. Our story comes from reporter Ann Bailey in Mongolia.
8-month-old Munk Erden wants attention. His two brothers are playing outside while his mother makes tea and tends the fire inside the family's ghare, or yurt. The air smells of smoke and cheese curd. It's a scene that could be any time in Mongolia, going back hundreds of years. And it could be just about anywhere in the country's vast open plains, where families of nomadic herders have followed their livestock for countless generations. But things are changing fast in Mongolia. And 2 years ago, this family set down its portable home in a place they never expected to end up. The country's crowded capital city, Ulaanbaatar. Outside the heavy canvas skin of the yurt is a sprawling patchwork of dirt roads, makeshift fences, and hundreds of yurts. Jarl Syken Erdenbeer gave up on herding and moved his family to the city after losing most of his livestock in a harsh winter. known here as a Zood. During that time, Erdenbeyer says so many nomadic families lost their herds. So they started moving here, and it's still happening. Zoods have always been part of life in Mongolia, but with climate change, they seem to be coming more often. And that's contributing to a cascade of problems. Lost traditions, displacement, overcrowding, and smog.
There is like this dome over the city, this gray dome.
That's Tugudur Chulambatar. He's an activist here in Ulaanbaatar. I talked to him in his car as he gave me a tour of some of the new neighborhoods. Ulaanbaatar is surrounded by mountains. And in the wintertime, all these new residents burn whatever they have to stay warm.
Mostly coal, but some people tend to burn like other things, you know, the tires, plastics, you know.
Those are very dirty fuels, made worse by inefficient traditional stoves. And the smoke from all that burning gets trapped beneath the colder air above the mountains, contributing to air quality in this city of 1.4 million people that can be worse than in notoriously polluted megacities like Beijing and Mumbai. Jargosik and Erdenbeyer's family alone burns 3 tons of coal a winter. He knows that heating his family's home this way is unhealthy, but he doesn't see another way. Burning coal is the only option, he says. Mongolia has no natural gas, and electricity is expensive. The government has spent millions of dollars in recent years to fight air pollution, and it has plans to build high-rise apartments with central heating for families now living in yurts. But progress has been slow, and many migrants don't want to give up their traditional homes for walls of concrete. Many still hope to go back to their old ways. But that may be an unrealistic hope.
Desertification is a real issue.
Desertification is a real issue, says Batjar Gozamba. He's a meteorologist and an advisor to Mongolia's Ministry of the Environment.
And according to the global warming, the arid area in Mongolia will expand.
Global warming will expand the dry parts of Mongolia, Zamba says. That means there will be fewer nomadic families, more migration to Ulaanbaatar, and more challenges for the city. Local activists know there's not much they can do to solve those big problems, but they are pushing for change. People like Chulambatar, the guy who gave me a tour of Ulaanbaatar's new neighborhoods, he gives them to a lot of people.
But it's not like tourism is tour. It's more like giving to people more realistic information about Ulaanbaatar.
Chulambatar is part of a community project that maps environmental and social conditions in the Ger, or yurt, district. Everything from average distance to a water supply, to locations of illegal trash dumps, to air pollution. The goal is to use the data to help rally support for action.
It's really hard to make the government do something when you're alone, but by the community it's really strong because the voice is really strong.
And things are slowly changing. The government has rolled out tax breaks for small business to produce better stoves, and it's created incentives to encourage residents to heat with somewhat cleaner electricity. But Erdenbeyer, the former herder, says he hasn't noticed any improvements. Air pollution is a big issue, he says. It's very dangerous for us to live here. And against all odds, he and his family still dream of returning to the country, where the air is clean. I want to continue with my nomadic lifestyle, Erdenbeyer says. I love herding. For The World, Anne Bailey, Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia.
Marco Werman here. You're with The World. Last week in Poland, President Trump gave a speech in a very symbolic location in front of a monument to the Warsaw Uprising. It was a reminder of Poland's painful wartime history. The 1944 Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis left tens of thousands of people dead and much of Warsaw in ruins. But for many Poles, it's also a moment of national pride and honor. This week on The World, we're going to take a look at another moment of Polish World War II history, one that's left a much murkier legacy that is especially painful still today. That moment was a wartime massacre in a tiny Polish town called Jawabna. The World's Nina Porzuki was there recently.
It's school break this week, and the village kids are assembled in the pews for church camp. A few girls pastor a young priest with a guitar about what to sing next. My producer, Ursula, speaks with the young popular priest. His name is Father Seraphine. Will he talk with us about the history of the town? Sure, he says. after Mass. If wars leave scars, then Poland has a deep red gash through its middle. Poland was the epicenter of World War II in Europe. For 6 years, the country was fought on both fronts. Stalin from the east and Germans from the west. 5 million Poles died during the war, 3 million of those Polish Jews. That's one-fifth of the population. No village was untouched. And today, if you walk around any Polish town or village, big or small, it's impossible, it seems, not to bump into some monument commemorating the war. What does this do to a nation?
The monument in Jawabna commemorates that massacre I mentioned a minute ago. It happened on July 10th, 1941. So today is the anniversary. We'll hear the rest of Nina's story from the village Friday here on The World. I want to leave you today with a story about a young man from Iran's capital, Tehran, and the unlikely bond he developed there with a rock band from California.
The first song I ever heard from Linkin Park was the song Numb. And when I played it, you know, right off the bat, I just felt really connected to the guitar riffs and the lyrics and the rage. I realized I could really connect with the music mainly because I happened to feel like a failure at that time. You know, I felt like maybe my existence didn't matter at all. And here is this song that talks about I'm becoming this, all I want to do is be more like me and be less like you. It was very simple, but at the same time pretty profound. My name is Siavash Sadlu. I'm 29. I was born and raised in Tehran, Iran. Living in Iran, you know, a lot of times you feel like you're being robbed of the obvious things, you know, like, so the rage keeps creeping up.
It starts with one.
I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try. Keep that in mind. I designed this rhyme to explain in due time. All I know.
My dad actually got killed in the Iran-Iraq War in 1988. I was just 3 months old when this happened. And so throughout my education, I attended schools that were specifically designed for kids who had lost their dads in the war. For me, the environment was suffocatingly stringent and obviously religious. So especially after elementary school, I really had this idea of breaking away from that environment, you know, mentally speaking. Obviously, physically, I wasn't able to materialize my idea or my aspiration. The first time I met them, it was at a coffee shop near central Tehran. It was like a modest Linkin Park fan club, and we were about 10, 12 people. People would like discuss the lyrics of Linkin Park's music, and, oh no, I think here the band is trying to make this a statement, or no, I think this is what they're trying to say. It was the coolest thing ever, you know, because I think when you're a teenager, one of the things you really strive to do is you want to be taken seriously. And a lot of us, we weren't taken seriously by our parents or especially our school teachers. When we found ourselves in such meetings, if you will, yeah, we felt like we were important people. And it was great. Obviously, we weren't able to see Linkin Park live, you know, in Iran. And I don't know if in my lifetime we will ever be able to see them live in Tehran. So We had to create our own version of reality, a reality that didn't exist, but we weren't afraid to dream. I don't know what's worth fighting for, or why I have to scream. I don't know why I instigate and say what I don't mean. I came to the U.S. in 2015, and I have a ticket for their concert in Mansfield on July 27th. And a friend of mine asked me, how are you going to react just like seeing them live? And I said, you know what, I'm not sure, I might cry, you know. And I'm sure for a lot of people that will be really silly, you know, it's, wait a minute, like, why are you crying at Linkin Park's concert, not even a pop concert or something? So, but they don't know this story. Probably one of the things I would tell them is they may not really know to what extent their music has inspired people like me, you know, from a place that has remained really obscure for the past 40 years because of politics. I don't know what's worth fighting for.
Siavash Sadlu is working on a memoir about growing up in Iran. He told his story to the world's Shirin Jafari. And that is a wrap for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.